Let's give everybody a second to get in and out of the courtroom. And you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice of the state. I'm Jerry Hutt. I represent Appellant Michael T. Jackson. This is an appeal from the denial of a excessive post-conviction.
Your counsel different from trial and appellate counsel, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, and actually there's been four attorneys prior to me.
Okay.
Mr. Jackson filed a number of issues. The district court made a determination as to whether or not an evidentiary hearing was should be held on one of those issues, and that had to do with the evidence tampering and outrageous government conduct claim that was raised. The district court determined that the allegations in the motion itself were insufficient to grant the hearing. We submit, however, that we did allege sufficient allegations to at least get us through the door and be able to submit evidence and conduct depositions and any other type of investigation that would have helped us advance that claim. The district court, as well as the state, relied on this court's determination in State versus Cook compared to our case for the factual allegations made in Cook, and we disagree with that connection. So in this case, what we had set forth in the motion is that Mr. Kofed was involved at the scene of the crime, collecting the evidence. There was a duffel bag that was found, I believe, by Officer Duesenschlager after the search of Mr. Jackson's girlfriend's car. At some point in time, another officer looked in that duffel bag, noticed that the clothes in there, that there were clothes in there, and that was then turned over to Mr. Kofed at the scene. At some point later in that same period of time, I believe it was next day, or early morning of the next day, Officer Duesenschlager went back to the crime lab to say what he considered a further inventory of the bag. At that time, it was noted in his report that the items of clothing had what appeared to be blood stains on them. There was no mention in the report of any method of testing at that time to determine whether or not the substance was in fact blood. It was just a mere observation by the officer. That very same day, the 5th of February, vials of blood that were taken from the victim, Mr. Thornton, at his autopsy were delivered into custody of the crime lab, Douglas County. That was for retention. It wasn't until 7 months later that the blood was delivered, after the blood was delivered, the clothing was sent to UNC for analysis.
Is this all before the trial?
Yes. It's all prior to trial.
Did the trial court indicate that the blood had been noted before Kofed got involved?
I think, are you asking the district court in the order denying the motion?
I think that's what it's saying.
The district court in denying the motion did note that, this is a little bit vague, I believe, as to whether or not he actually reviewed the records and files of the case. He said he did recall Duesenschlager having made mention of blood stains or a substance found on clothes. And I think there's a conflict in the reports that we have. We would be able to submit an evidentiary hearing as to what Officer Duesenschlager actually saw. My understanding from the reports is that he saw the clothes in the bag. At that time, referred that to either Officer Farrell or Mr. Kofed. Farrell was a detective at the scene at the time. And Mr. Farrell then reported to him that perhaps he had seen red stains on the clothes. Regardless, there's still no information as to what point it was determined it was blood. The only time we know for sure was 7 months after the clothing and the blood were both delivered to Douglas County Crime.
So your take on the status of the files and records is that before Kofed got involved, some of these individuals had noted something on the clothing, or something arguably blood.
I think the record reflects that at some point in time, Officer Farrell went through the bag. It's unclear at what point in time it occurred. It was during the initial investigation. He had searched the car, noticed some red stains, which I think he opined at trial could have been. But there was no scientific testing of that evidence until.
But this is your second motion for post-conviction relief.
That is correct, yes.
And on that, you've alleged that there were errors in jury instructions?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's
well,
my...
That's couldn't that have been raised in the first post-conviction?
Yes, and that's part of our argument.
Well, you don't get a claim of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel.
No, we don't, not under Hessler. We certainly tried to convince
so you don't
the court.
So you really don't get to that here, do you?
Well, and I think the only way that we can get there is ask the court to really reconsider and revisit the determination of Hessler that there's some requirement that we stop at ineffective assistance of counsel claims at the appellate level and not allow that as an equitable remedy in post-conviction. I think we can look at that.
Would the same apply for a conflict of interest?
Pardon me?
Would the same apply to your claim that counsel had a conflict of interest?
Well, I believe on that issue, the district court determined that that had been addressed and was procedurally barred.
Mm-hmm. What does equity have to do with post-conviction?
Well,
this is purely a statutory remedy, isn't it?
Correct. And the remedy, the statute itself, 29.3001, subsection 3, says that the district court need not consider successive post-conviction claims from the same individuals. This court, I believe 72 and Reichel, made the determination that unless you can meet the following factors, you're not going to get a second shot in.
And isn't the legislature's most recent amendment of the post-conviction statutes pertaining to a statute of limitations even more persuasive that Hessler was consistent with the legislative intent?
And I think that we met the statute of limitations in this case. But as far as filing, because we were under the new, within a year or by a date certain, transition when they changed the statute, and that's when everybody started filing the post-conviction. So it used to be open-ended. You could just file it at some point. And then they put the year limit and the specific date limit, I believe, was August of 2012 or September of 2012. That iteration of the statute.
Counsel, I have another sort of jurisdictional related
sure.
question. This appeal was, the order denying post-conviction relief was initially entered on December 15th.
Correct.
And then there was an oral motion to reinstate the appeal at some point because no appeal was taken from that original order. Is that right?
It was a written motion. I believe that's correct.
All right. And then the court did reinstate it on June 6th. Of last year?
Yes.
At the hearing on the request to vacate and reinstate, was there any evidence offered?
No.
Was there a hearing?
Well, there was not technically a hearing. There was an agreement between the parties, the Douglas County Attorney's Office, after speaking with the district court clerk's office about the error. We'd had transitioned to electronic filing at that time. And the notification system was supposed to automatically update it because they sent it to an older attorney, somebody that never actually represented Mr. Jackson at any point in the case.
But none of that is in our record?
None of that information is in the record, just the fact that the order allowing us to file the appeal.
But there was no evidence offered at that hearing?
No. It was agreed upon order between the parties.
You think the parties have the authority to extend the time for appeal?
But the judge does.
You think a trial judge has the authority to extend the time for appeal in the absence of evidence of a mistake by the clerk?
I do in this case, given the fact that the parties agreed that the evidence established informed the court that the evidence
is that agreement as to the underlying circumstances, is that in our record?
No.
Okay.
Is there some basis not to have a hearing on this error? Is there?
On the failure to notify parties that the order had been issued?
Right.
I don't.
I don't know. Could the court take judicial notice?
The court could of the records, yes. The records and files of the case have established that the wrong parties were notified.
But that would require a record, correct?
I believe he could take judicial notice of the district court.
You can't just do that out in the ether. You have to take it on the record. Was there a record?
No. But the state's not objected to jurisdiction.
I return to you. What authority do you have for the proposition that the parties, by agreement, may extend the time for appeal?
I don't have anything off the top of my head. That was part of the statutory scheme that we looked at. I believe it's cited.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Tangeman, good morning to you.
Aaron Tangeman, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Nebraska. I will start where this court ended. I came into this case a little late, so I do not know what the record says regarding the reinstatement of the appeal. I believe it was Kenny Robinson, or there was some Robinson case where this court talked about reinstatement of a post-conviction appeal if there was some type of error on the part of the clerk's office or something of the like.
Doesn't that require evidence to establish that there was an error?
Yes. Now, if the state agrees and stipulates,
and
I don't
isn't
know.
That stipulations are a form of evidence, right?
Right. And like I said, I don't know what the record shows here.
All right.
My understanding is that the state was not contesting the reinstatement.
But that's a different proposition.
Yes.
Do you think the state can confess by agreement in the absence of facts that would support a claim of mistake by the clerk, you think the state can agree to extend the time for appeal?
I think probably what most likely the state is allowed to do is to stipulate to the facts that make the reinstatement appropriate, and then the district court would make a determination based on
that. But that stipulation would have to be on the record. And you don't know what.
I don't know.
Right.
I apologize.
Which is fair.
That was an issue for this case.
Okay. Thank you.
Regarding the third assignment of error, that he is entitled to an evidentiary hearing to show that Kofod fabricated or planted the evidence used against him at trial. He alleges that Kofod fabricated or planted the deceased victim's blood on his clothing after it was found in the duffel bag on the night of the murder.
How do you get to that on the second motion for post-conviction?
Well, I don't think there's a timeliness issue because he filed it within the statute of limitations.
He filed what within the statute of limitations?
His successive post-conviction motion. I believe the court addressed the Kofod issue on whether or not the allegations were sufficient to have an evidentiary hearing. I don't think there was any procedural bar type issue at that time, just based on when the Kofod stuff in other cases came to light.
Wasn't that something that could have been raised in the first post-conviction based on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim for not proceeding?
First post-conviction dates back to, I believe, the early 2000s. I'm not exactly sure. So whether or not the Kofod claim could have been raised at that point, I think their main basis of that claim is based on his history of fabricating in other cases, and that obviously did not come to light.
That's just a theory. There isn't anything in the record that establishes that the evidence was tampered with. Is
correct.
It? It's just an allegation.
This is just an allegation.
Is that an allegation of constitutional magnitude?
Yes. The state believes that the simple fact that Kofod was involved in an investigation does not automatically establish that post-conviction relief is warranted or even that an evidentiary hearing is warranted. And this court demonstrated as much in the State v. Cook case from 2015. We believe the state is more similar to Cook than it is the State v. Edwards case, where an evidentiary hearing was granted on the Cook vote issue. The allegations raised by Jackson in his motion to show that Kofod fabricated the evidence are not sufficient to warrant a hearing. This is not a case where the blood evidence was located by Kofod only after other law enforcement officers failed to find it. Instead, the apparent bloodstains were found at the time the clothing was located in the vehicle, so thus upon the initial search.
And that was by one of the officers or investigators?
Yes, multiple officers. I believe one officer found it initially, and he then assigned two more officers to help him. They both, at least one specifically testified to seeing blood on the jeans at the time of the scene.
Blood or red stains?
Well, red stains, yes, apparent blood, I believe was maybe a term that was used. All of this happened before Kofod even arrived on the scene to take custody of clothing. Once he did take custody of the clothing, he and at least one other officer took inventory of that clothing back at the station, and photographs were taken of the clothing at that time. At the time the stains were located and the photographs were taken, Kofo did not have access to the vials of the victim's blood. Law enforcement did not receive the victim's blood until hours after the clothing was inventoried and photographed, and thus it was impossible for Kofo to plant the stains on the clothing.
So is that in our record?
Yeah, well, some of it is specifically in the record that can be considered as substantive evidence. Others is attached to his post-conviction motion, which I think makes it relevant in terms of allegations. Regarding the other two assignments of error, the state's position that because this is a successive motion, both of these could have been raised before and are clearly procedurally barred. I do not have anything else to add unless this court has specific questions regarding assignments of error. We ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. The court then will go on to the next case of the day, which is Burns versus Burns.